This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is the London FinTech Podcast, episode 12. One hears the phrase fintech so often, it's easy to forget that it's comprised of two separate things, even if the overly excited pronounce that they are converging. Just for clarity, fin is a social, or perhaps at worst antisocial, activity between human beings, and the tech is the method of recording and transacting. These are old concepts. Some of the first accounting entries, the fin, were chiselled thousands of years ago in stone, the tech. Bankrupt, definitely a fin concept in recent decades, comes from the custom of breaking the bench of an insolvent medieval Italian moneylender. Reuters got the jump on stock exchange information by utilising the first telegraph wires. So the need to ensure the alignment and smooth interoperation of fin and tech is absolutely at the heart of fintech. It's an area where experience most definitely pays, and so I'm delighted to welcome on this show Farid Tijani, who has long history in this area, most recently as the founder of an exciting and fast-growing next-generation consultancy company called Igniter. Their business is working with fintechs large and small on this innovation journey. Farid is well-placed to discuss the gluing together of these fin and tech components. So let's get on with the show. Hi, Farid. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Well, actually, thinking about it, I've got that one wrong. It's probably thank you for having me, and we're in level 42 at the moment on a beautiful day looking down the Thames and looking at the city from a distance. For those of you that don't know level 42, it's where, in a way, people graduate to from level 39, I believe, which most people have heard of.
Yeah, we're very, very lucky. We've got a great view of our entire playground over the City of London and a really collaborative, exciting space to play in.
So before we get on to the excitement of fintech, and as I say, the meat of the show, which I see as this problem going back thousands of years to ancient Sumerian and perhaps before of how you do a certain type of activity between people and then keep track of it. How come you got into this whole field? And in a sense, what was it that made the penny drop for you that there are fin and tech components that need to be stuck together in the first place?
Well, I guess we have to roll back a little bit. I started out personally studying sciences and used that to springboard onto behavioural science and cognitive social thinking at university. So I've always been really interested in how people interact and engage with each other and transact value and come to agreements and make decisions. My first internet startup was actually back in 1997, 98, so a very long time ago. And remember, this is basically kind of pre-Google, pre-PayPal.
Yeah, yeah. No, I had an office with a laptop in 1998, so it was Alta Vista for me then.
Right, exactly, right. And back in those days, we were trying to sell sustainable and upcycled products online. And we made, you know, as a startup, we made...
So just for the audience as well as for me, actually, I'll pretend it's the audience. So just for the audience, because I understand completely, what is an upcycle product?
So a product that's reached its end of life and then is repurposed, but repurposed for a better use. So something like recycled circuit boards turned into, you know, or discarded circuit boards turned into coasters or something like that.
Right. It sounds like the sort of thing I should have done when I was 50, actually, be sort of recycled and upurposed.
I think we still have some, actually, somewhere in the office.
You can recycle them later.
I'll see if I can find one. So at that time, 97, 98, you know, we were just young and we didn't have the benefits of all of the engineering methods. We didn't have the benefits of all of the models of innovation that we do today. And so we, of course, made every single mistake you could possibly imagine. And, you know, in 6 or 9 months, the business tanked. No one could get their head around the idea of even transacting online. There was no online marketplace for buying and selling on the internet at the time. And so we quickly failed forwards.
Yes, I've had this phenomenon many times in my life. I've done all the right things, but generally sort of 10 or 20 years early. So anybody listening today, they should start a fintech podcast in 10 years and you'll make your billions. And it's often thought that if you're some kind of visionary or you get some insight and you know what really needs to be done, that that's an advantage. Well, frankly, if there is a next time round, if the Buddhists are right, I think I want to be somebody who doesn't think in advance because it's much easier to go along with a crowd. But clearly you're sort of somebody who's quite sharp, sees through it. But that causes its own set of problems.
Indeed, first mouse doesn't always get the cheese, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, so in between then and Igniter, I worked first for Compaq Computer, who became part of HP. Then I worked for a services company called Imago QA, which became part of Microgen, which you might know now. And then in about 2000, I helped set up the UK's first software quality assurance consultancy. And we were a very small team designed to really create a new product, a new service, and take it to market as a services organisation. And then after that, in 2005, I was hired by SunGard to set up a professional services team within their securities financing division, which was again a brand new, effectively a startup inside a large corporate organisation. And I did a bunch of interesting investment banking projects during that, you know, those 12, 15 years, including a stint in New York, a stint in Amsterdam, a stint in Frankfurt, and a stint in Jersey.
Which of those did you like living in most?
I always came back to London.
Oh, right, okay. Well, that's the right answer for London, isn't it?
Yeah. I had options and always chose London, actually, for a number of reasons. So as well as working for some investment banks, I did some really interesting work for some VCs. I did some interesting work for some startups and some angels as well, evaluating startups. So there was quite a lot of varied work in those roles, almost all in finance. So I've always really worked in startup services organisations, and sometimes directly for startups and sometimes directly for large financial institutions.
So you have what I've come to see this year as really critical, which is a bunch of practical experience and a bunch of falling over and scraping your knee and making all the mistakes and sticking your finger in the flames and finding it's hot. And that is really invaluable. And one hears time and time again amongst especially the young folks who've tuned into the Silicon Valley vibe, fail fast. Well, that's fine, but if you keep failing, you don't really get anywhere. And your average 20-something, or early 20-something for sure, would be much better off getting a job with a fintech and finding out what it's like on the inside rather than starting on the outside.
To learn from someone else's mistakes. I mean, really, it's often said that the only way that we learn is from either our mistakes or from other people's mistakes. We
absolutely
rarely learn, you know, cognitively in that sense.
Absolutely. So I really wonder whether it's not, coming back to your behavioural sciencey stuff, whether it's not a very important part of the human journey, basically to cock things up a few times before you're ready kind of to do it properly.
Right, yeah.
All the mythology is about the sort of the Bill Gateses and the Steve Jobs, but even they didn't get it right first time. You know, the average Tiger Woods of whatever industry has hit a million golf balls.
Indeed. And that is an unfolding process. I mean, that journey of discovery. And certainly for me, there weren't any particularly big aha moments. There weren't any complete awakenings. But instead, I had an amazing, like throughout my entire career so far, I've had an amazing series of conversations with hugely interesting and intelligent people that have really influenced and inspired me. So perhaps to single out a few people, maybe Simon Davies at the LSE and the Director of Privacy International, who I was, you know, very close communication with over the early 2000s. And perhaps maybe Sir Howard Davies, who I saw speak many years ago when he was Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, both of whom are hugely respected and intelligent individuals in their field, who are part of the system and yet have maintained a healthy ability to kind of critique and influence and guide their industries forwards with vision. So there's probably a story there that, you know, my therapist might be able to help you with
about
how to guide and influence. But certainly the people that are influencing me and certainly the people that have influenced the creation of Igniter have been very much those who have been on the inside who are able to actually critique and guide to a better place.
It's a point that I really, really like, actually. I haven't heard it explained so clearly in the past, because people either tend to be skeptics and cynics, it's all rubbish, or they tend to be, oh, it's all wonderful, I'll just become part of the machine. And there's nothing wrong with either of those positions. It's a relatively free country. You can kind of do what you want. But as you're saying, the ones who can actually effect the most change see the strengths and weaknesses simultaneously. They're in the world, but not of the world at the same time.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's no value really in trying to influence outcomes from the outside. And I think that the innovation, disruption, fintech stuff that's happening at the moment is very much testament to that. It's not organisations trying to pressure from outside for better outcomes.
Let's move on to this core theme then. So as you explained, clearly you've got a whole bunch of experience and a whole bunch of stuff, and you're still young compared to me, but you're more middle-aged than you used to be. And this fintech stuff is emerging very rapidly in 2014. What are your main thoughts at the moment about kind of where it all is and how it all makes sense and what needs to be done and what's working well? And, you know, that's what it sounds like, one of my usual questions where I just ask about six questions in one go. Please don't answer yes or no.
I suppose where we started, what you started the opening section about, how do the fin and tech relate? And if you think about it, the technology has always been more than just a pivotal part of the banking and finance industry for the last 50 years. The truth is that...
Well, I think I was saying last 5,000 at the beginning. Well, I'll buy 50. We can agree on that.
Well, by modern computing standards, with the advent of the PC and software programming and so on, if we look at the disruptive new in the industry, we can see events right back through the 1960s. So Barclays Bank in London, in Enfield of all places, opening the first world's first ATM, world's first cash point machine in 1967.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay.
And it took 10 years for, I think, you know, any sort of semblance of a meaningful rollout of ATMs in New York. I mean, that was 1977, I think, whereby Citi. If you think about the first electronic trading platforms and the first electronic information systems that helped investment banks, that happened in the late 70s, and that was, again, British companies with their love affair with software programming, embedding themselves inside financial services in order to be able to improve the world and change the way that finance worked.
And so, again, that took a good decade or so to actually get anywhere. So I remember when I was in the investment management division, I went to see the dealing floor. And I think in those early days, we only dealt in-house, which was something I managed to get changed eventually. And on the dealing floor, a guy called Charlie Hall Thompson, who used to make a lot of money from floating rate notes sales, he was very sexed up because he had a spreadsheet. And on this spreadsheet, it had like plus a quarter in LIBOR and all that kind of stuff. And then we're talking, so that's mid to late 80s still.
There's a picture on a blog post on our website which shows in 77 traders at Chase Manhattan Bank, and they were FX traders getting their pricing updates from a peg letter board which was updated every 3 hours by one of the assistants
who would take
telexes and I suppose and information about prices and you know implementing.
So it's amazing how much has changed literally in our lifetimes.
Correct. Yeah, fintech absolutely, and in banking, like fintech has been around as a technology initiating disruption in finance. Has been happening for the last 30, 40 years plus.
And one would argue, presumably, that at an accelerating pace.
Indeed.
So what took 10 years, as you say, from ATM to whatever, or trading platform to whatever, maybe it does it in less than a year these days, perhaps.
Right, so innovation cycles are shortening, and that's really interesting. That is what's happening right now. So since about 2012, the planets are starting to align around this fashionable term, which is fintech innovation. Of course, the problem is that if you're the size of a planet, even very small things, you know, very small changes don't happen particularly quickly. So what we see is, inside organizations, the truth is that, you know, large institutions often have internal obstacles that make it difficult for them to deliver creative, innovative solutions. And those things might be cultural, they might be political, they might be organizational, there might be legacy infrastructure or something else.
Yes, when I was a lad and had to read economics textbooks, it's a thing that used to be called, probably still is, diseconomies of scale. And those are the textbooks that were written in the days before the large organizations got so good at lobbying, particularly in America, but also in Europe, that the diseconomies of scale were overcome by getting regulation to prop them up. But as you say, absolutely.
Quite, yeah. And, you know, in reality, I mean, larger the size of the organization, the more difficult it is. They're just simply not very good at doing the innovation space activity and tend to focus a little bit more on the simple, predictable activities that really run the day-to-day business.
Or as a distribution conduit. So there's this famous article, Unbundling the Corporation and the HBR ages ago, which said that corporations will split down into different things. I mean, and what you're talking about, we've seen happen far more in pharmaceuticals, where these vast combines are actually just distribution vehicles, and they tend to insource the innovation from little smart folks, half a dozen guys with a few test tubes or whatever.
Indeed.
They do.
Indeed, and that's a very similar thing is now obviously happening in finance at the moment. So when we talk about innovation, what we really mean is kind of two things, really. On the one hand, we mean the idea of embracing the potential for change by encouraging more organisational agility. So organisational agility as a concept is often reduced to a management buzzword.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds great, but you're going outside in Canary Wharf, going to a big building and try and make them agile.
Yeah, right, okay, so yeah, exactly. So
probably a good business.
It's in a PowerPoint slide. But actually, there are many small changes and real changes that an organization can take in order to improve its ability to adapt to changing market conditions and customer needs. I mean, I think we all know that many large organizations have perhaps more than a few friction points and inefficiencies in their decision making. And equally, many technology teams inside large organizations are perhaps less than totally flexible in their willingness to respond quickly to changing demands.
Yes, I think that, I mean, it's a question of what your main job is. And if you're in one of these vast organizations with a quarter of a million people or a third of a million people, the main job in those kind of IT departments is keeping the show on the road, which ain't as easy as it sounds.
Right, and that is, look, though, you know, know, it is extraordinarily hard.
You introduce a new system, whatever, you perturb the existing order, and it might cock things up. And
right.
It's not an enviable task.
Right, indeed. And, you know, running the banks, running large financial services institutions is extraordinarily challenging. And very often, innovation areas, innovation activity, that is to say, thinking about how to adapt your organization to be able to, and adapt your teams to be able to be more successful in the future and future-proof yourself against certain things that are maybe just over the horizon, is actually not necessarily the highest priority, or at least it's not necessarily the most critical thing that's happening today.
Yes, I think that's very, just pressing pause on that one, it's an important point. So, as I've said a number of times, simplifying it, there are two types of fintech, one of whom is trying to provide financial services directly to customers or consumers in competition with existing financial services organizations. Another, which is perhaps in the majority, is trying to sell into financial services as clients. And I think that those who are trying to sell into financial services as clients really do need to get their head around the fact that actually these big banks have their own challenges, but the people in them aren't completely stupid and they're acting rationally try and do the job as they know it. So
absolutely.
If you can understand that mentality, it can shorten this sales cycle. You see people whinging, understandably, about 2 or 3 year sales cycles to banks. That's fine. Well, one way to shorten that is to understand where they're coming from.
Quite.
And presumably it's what part of you, you know, what you do when you're helping these smaller firms.
Quite. Well, I think with the idea about the, you know, the parallels with the pharma industry, for example, are pretty good in that sense. And I think the pharmaceuticals industry are understood very quickly because clearly they're organized, you know, pharmaceuticals is fundamentally based on innovation in that sense. If you're not producing new drugs and have a pipeline, then you clearly don't have the chance to be able to be remain competitive, and drugs have shelf lives and so on and so forth. So I think that is very much the case with finance today, and I think that there are things that organizations can do. So for example, I mean, the adoption of like interesting engineering disciplines like lean startup theory and agile engineering and all those sorts of things can help foster a culture where there is more of a partnership and more of a trust-based relationship between the fin and the tech. And sometimes the dysfunction in that relationship can lead to, let's say, an organization that doesn't produce the best long-term outcomes.
I mean, often you have the fin people leading or the tech people leading, and that's not really optimal because coming back to fintech, whether it's small or in large organizations, you need the two in balance. And I've seen countless examples. I could bang on for hours about how many examples I've seen of where it's imbalanced and what happens when you can balance it, even relatively balance the two.
I think we've all suffered the consequences of disharmony, I suppose.
I think if you get the fin and tech out of balance, it's like somebody makes your left leg longer than your right leg or your right leg longer than the left leg, and then tells you to walk with your eyes shut, you end up going in circles.
Pretty good.
Exactly. You can take that if you're marketing material. Small thing.
Thanks
later.
Very much. Yeah, cheers. We'll take that under consideration. The fun stuff starts to happen, I think, when you get that synchronicity, coherence in the relationship. And the first thing that tends to happen is that it then sort of, you know, energy is outwardly focused more towards customers, right, and customer needs. And as part of the kind of the journey towards being able to be more organizationally agile is that a signal to noise ratios with customer feedback improves.
So what does that mean in English?
It means there is more energy and attention paid to customers' needs. And once that happens, you can then see organizations shortening the feedback loops with their customers so they can...
You're then back to capitalism, aren't you, which is selling stuff that people want.
Well, something like that, right? Which is, you know, in that sense, it's not an insane idea. If you are in the business of making money from your customers, then really give them what they need, and that's not revolutionary. But it seems to be something that, from an energy point of view, is somehow there are many distractions and filters and barriers to that.
Absolutely, and I think it's very much a question of scale. So if you're a small company selling cupcakes, you have got to sell cupcakes that people are going to buy from you. By the time you're the largest baker in the country, you've just produced the bulk cupcake, or cheese is probably a better example. You go into the supermarket and you buy your average cheddar, it would taste like average cheddar does, but if you're a small cheese manufacturer. So I think as the scale grows, it's very hard to remain customer focused.
But there are lots of technology innovations that can help with that. There are lots of moves forward in technology that allow much better activity to engage with your customers.
Right. So I think that's the really interesting bit, isn't it? Because otherwise, frankly, you're a bit stuffed if you're a big bank. Without anything to try and enable what you're talking about, it's really tough. You can espouse it at board level, but by the time it's gone 15 levels down the hierarchy.
Right, but essentially producing something like that is actually quite relatively trivial, and showing value of those sorts of solutions is extremely easy. You know, things like split testing or A-B testing or analytics or big data mining and that sort of stuff can happen quite quickly once you've built systems that work in that way to pay attention to customers' needs. So you can build those feedback loops into your system as you develop them. But what's really interesting about at this point is that the disciplines and methods, you know, they can be learned. They're not something airy-fairy in the ether. They are actually genuine disciplines that engineers and business people working with engineers can learn to take advantage of.
Moving towards your Igniter hat, what's the best way that you found to make that happen in practice or encourage people on that journey? Is it something like sandboxing, which says, okay, let's leave everything unchanged, let's take this small area as a little pilot study or whatever, and let's do, you know, a bit of this? Or do you just sort of try and go to the board and spend months convincing them? And
it depends. We've got a lot of very strategic visionary clients and individuals that we're talking to at senior level inside large financial services organizations.
I think they're waking up, because even if you just read the Evening Standard, you come across this fintech word and, you know, all these companies who are sort of nibbling away at your business, all that
right.
kind of stuff.
Right.
So there's
right.
I think there's a certain amount of panic and fear as well in some quarters. It's kind of, forgive my French, it's shit, you know, which at least temporarily freezes, but then they're much more motivated to take action than they would have been before.
So we're really lucky because we've got some really good clients and potential clients that we're talking to who are at senior level in large financial services organizations, large banks, large investment banks mainly, who are getting slightly past the oh shit moment and getting slightly into, in fact,
what are we going to do?
And in fact, bringing some really intelligent ideas and some really intelligent solutions to the table and with an open mind. And I think that's the point about exploratory design, about innovation engineering, is that the fundamental assumption of we're going to, let's say, build a platform, or we're going to implement a new trading system, or we're going to do a new, you know, do a back office refresh or an upgrade, and we know what we want, has fallen away as a result of this fintech disruption animal. So that's where it's kind of getting really interesting. But it's also kind of, it's also quite interesting in the space of the next generation of banking customers, of consumer banking customers. So things like the new generation of millennials, where, you know, they have a completely different relationship with financial services and they think in a completely different way. So as we sort of think about that group of people becoming customers of at least retail banks, and if not, you know, more, then we see them being much more digitally connected and much higher expectations of, you know, social communities. And then we throw into the sort of mix about the breakdown of trust between the producer and the consumer, that is, you know, the you know, financial institutions and the general public. We can see why and how sort of these fintech startups are co-opting financial services and addressing and redistributing some of the power balances towards the individuals and communities away from the institutions.
Yes, it's an interesting point. I haven't heard this particular feedback loop expressed so clearly, but in terms of talking about fin and tech and the impact on the world and the impact on existing financial services organizations, clearly one of the things, as you say, is that the mere existence of tech is changing their customers, is changing the consumers, is changing what a human being in their 20s is like compared to somebody in their 60s or 70s. And that forces a very subtle need for change, or a less subtle need to change perhaps in the organisation serving them.
I suppose the other concept in fintech innovation for us that's really interesting is that this concept of what we might call true disruption. And that's caused by more strategic inflection points in fintech.
When you say true disruption, what do you mean? Because I'm sure many people could define true disruption to be many things.
Okay, so I'm talking about things that are going to systemically change the financial services industry.
Okay.
That, let's say, things that might cause us to jump onto different rails entirely.
Like Bitcoin or something completely
potentially,
radical.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the blockchain stuff is quite interesting because, you know, these are mainly technical in origin, but also inspired by social change. So there's a bottom-up thing here going on. And they will invert the way that we think about how financial services functions. So if we stop and think about how financial services works for a second, and how the banking system works. And I suppose we inevitably arrive at the conclusion that financial services makes money out of one thing, right? And that's the information asymmetry between different entities that hold assets. And now we see a new generation of technical and creative individuals and small companies and large companies that are also doing this, that are short-circuiting the communication line between those that allow that information asymmetry to exist.
Absolutely. So just taking a practical example, I can't remember my first bonus. Actually, I didn't have bonuses in those days. I don't know where it came from. Anyway, I had £1,000 not long after being in the city, and I put it in a building society, like walking around the block near me, and whichever one had the highest account rate. And then a few weeks later, I was wandering around, and then suddenly its account rate was rubbish, and it was another one. So my ability to get the information in those days was limited by how much shoe leather I had. This is the 80s, walking around the city. Whereas these days, as you say, you can go online to one of the comparison sites and there is no information asymmetry, because I could probably know faster than you the bank if I want to.
Right.
Or at the same speed. Right. So that's what we're practically talking about.
Right, right.
In the past, banks and other large organisations would arbitrage the fact that you didn't know, well, it could be tomatoes, you know, that you didn't know you could buy tomatoes cheaper in the next road.
Right, right. And it happens at every level in banking. So if you think about corporate debt issues or whatever it is, you know, I don't know, there's lots and lots and lots of examples. But that's really how it's all functioning today.
So it's this collapse of this information asymmetry. We're all on a level playing field now.
Indeed, indeed. And there's no advantage, or the advantage to being large is diminishing very quickly. And so there is a material threat, I think.
Absolutely. So moving on to Ignite, time's rushing by as it does. So which of the issues that you're talking about is Ignite particularly focusing on, helping the sort of smaller or medium or the larger fintechs or existing organisations with at the moment? What are you guys up to that you think is particularly interesting for folks tuning in, and vice versa? What kind of services can you offer?
Okay, so I mean, look, many of the trailing banks that are out there, many of the banks that are not really kind of on this journey yet or are not into and don't intend to, you know, we expect to simply, you know, pretty much evaporate as the asymmetry advantage, you know, falls away.
Or putting it in ruder terms, those banks are off the curve or screwing their clients, they ain't going to last.
There is an argument in that direction, yeah. I mean, look, where Ignite positions itself is pretty unique, okay? So we're financial services only, and we work with large and small organisations, and we're innovation experts, and that's cool, and we're tech. But I guess the more important thing is that we play with everyone, right? We play with small startups and large financial service corporations, from tier ones all the way down.
And this fits my view, which is why I've got this picture of the Tower Bridge on my logo, that financial services or fintech or whatever you have is something which is in the middle of the bridge. It's an activity. It's an activity which can be done by big, bad, old, or new, young, sexy, or fins or techs. It's a thing in the middle, isn't it?
Right, right. The perceived benefits of bringing startups into large services organisations at the moment is only one way to really embrace innovation. It's only one way for large financial services organisations to take on board new ideas. It's expensive, and it's not always successful, and it's happening to varying degrees. It's, you know, essentially an M&A play. But there are other interesting and potentially more sustainable ways to bring innovation into a bank. So essentially the way that we work is that we can embed ourselves inside organisations as, you know, in small teams or single individuals that help foster that culture, help share that knowledge and share those disciplines around teams, and that's, you know, at a strategic level or really all the way down to the really hands-on stuff. And at the same time, as an organization, we have some of our large corporate clients coming to us and saying, well, look, this is great, this is, you know, it's great that you can help us, but the reality is that maybe we can't do all of this, or we can't do all of the creative ideas, deliver all of the creative ideas that we want to deliver. And so can you take a few away for us? And so from that angle, we have development team and full build capability that we can just take a problem away and build prototypes and start to iterate with them and start to deliver some concepts that may be interesting, and they want to then take it further forwards themselves or continue to use us to help work with.
So you can help them in-house or out-house, and how it stuck in my mind was on the in-house while I was thinking about when the British Army pulls out of all these places that it keeps going and fighting in, as it has for centuries, like Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever, and things go bad again. Then they send a few advisors to go in there and work and train the people and change their mentality and try and sort of toughen them up. And in a sense, that's your in-house thing. You can send some of your leading-edge folks to go in there and effect change by changing hearts and minds, coming back to your behavioural sciences background at the beginning. And you get a real leverage effect then, because, you know, a handful of people can make a huge difference if they start converting some of the locals. And then this interesting one, which I haven't heard as a model so much of, is the outhouse stuff, which is a little bit like when Toyota decided it wanted to build a radically new car. It thought, oh, well, we Toyota can't do that. So they created Lexus in a green field. And on a smaller scale, if some large organization knows that it's got these internal issues. And I remember hearing a story about the foundation of Egg Bank and Mike Harris, the founder of Egg Bank, speaking to the chairman of Midland Bank, who said, look, go ahead, you can have the 20 million to make this happen. He said, but whatever you do, don't tell anybody inside the bank, because they'll just kill it.
Right.
This is the chairman of the bank. So he said, look, please go off and do that. You know, and when it's kind of going along, come back and let me know.
Right. So, yeah, a little bit like the Lockheed Skunk Work kind of model.
Exactly. Absolutely. So, you know, on a smaller scale, rather than building Egg Bank, that's something that you can do for your clients as well, which is you can take stuff away and say, look, do you know what? We'll go away and we'll do this for you. We'll come back in a day, a week, a month, a year, or whatever it takes. And, you know, and show you that, and that can save you a lot of time.
Correct.
So it sounds like you've got a very flexible range of services for the banks, and it sounds like that, you know, the time is right for people trying a lot of these things. And where we started was saying you're level 42, which sits a couple of floors above level 39, where there's lots of startups. And when you go out for lunch, you can't avoid the fact in Canary Wharf these days that there are millions of people at the sandwich shops, and so there's a lot of potential customers around here.
Indeed, yeah, indeed. And you know, we really try to play true to the statement that we do play with everyone. So, you know, we also mentor for level 39, mentor for the startups down there, we mentor for the level for the startup bootcamp guys, we mentor at Wayra, we're involved in all of the accelerators. Yeah. We have a number of startups on our client books as well, and we're doing some really interesting stuff with them. I mean, we've got a startup who is building an embedded carbon risk analysis tool to, you know, for fund managers to be able to establish the carbon intensity of their portfolio. We've got we've done big trade data analytics for large corporates, you know, using algorithm stuff, and we've done gamified trading, you know, CFD trading platforms for other startups.
Contracts with differences for those not involved in financial services. It doesn't really matter. There's all these boring, strange things that folks change around here.
So for us, I mean, from my perspective, it's just an incredibly exciting time to be working in financial technology.
No, I think it is, and thank you for that, Farid. It's a very interesting overview and very insightful. I think time's gone by far, very fast it is. I think just to wrap up, I'm reminded of when we were talking beforehand, before we did introduction, about what word I use in the introduction, and we're talking about the pros and cons of using the word consultancy. So the cons for those people not involved, those in financial services will know, is that consultancy has tended to become just a conduit for providing bodies into an organisation. It's gone down the value chain and become commoditised for many people. Oh, you want 100 people? Oh, here you go, here's 100 people. But set against that, that's not really how consultancy started, and it certainly isn't for the likes of McKinsey, are still sort of doing it in a very sexy way. And so we settled on this phrase, next generation consultancy, or rebirth of consultancy, and I can see that you're very much that. You're not in the business of providing half a dozen bodies to some large project, but you are in the business of providing a sort of, you know, two or three SAS blokes who are going to make a huge change.
Quite indeed. And we find that our customers really feel that it's very valuable.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for that, Farid, and good luck for the future.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts of new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.